attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea. Is it?
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will, and I'm joined by my co-host, Conrad.
Hello.
And in this episode, we're delighted to be once again joined by a previous guest, an activist for the Labour Party and for our future's sake, Nathan Baroda. Welcome back to the podcast, Nathan.
Thanks very much, Will. Great to be back.
So to begin with, I'd like to ask, how did you initially react when you saw the exit poll?
Yeah, just shock, devastation, regret about how this country's going. But look, it was a terrible, terrible moment for our party and I believe our country. When that exit poll came out, I mean, I was actually at one of the counts and just seeing the jubilation on the faces of those with blue rosettes and looking around to see my colleagues and friends, you know, devastated about the result. It wasn't a nice evening, to say the least.
So obviously the election has changed a lot of things, and one of those things is it means Brexit will happen now. The bill's passed through the House of Commons. What are your thoughts about this as sort of someone who's campaigned for a people's vote in the past?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I quite like it to go to a referendum so that people can have their say on the deal in particular, but I know that's not going to happen. Although Boris's lack of principle is extremely high, and although he did make the case for two referendums at the beginning of the campaign, as did Dominic Cummings, although he wrote two articles, that's not going to happen because that's the political reality. What I'd say now is, look, we need to, you know, get adjust and get ready for Brexit, as those famous signs said for the October deadline. And not just in terms of what we do in terms of food, etc., but it is a political reality as well. And obviously the extent to which, you know, we don't know the deal yet, but the extent to which it is bad and the implications it has for the economy will then decide the next step that we take. Our priority obviously has to be avoiding a sort of a hard Brexit. Obviously that's a subjective term, at least for GB, because of the implications that would have for jobs, workers' rights, and our economy. If the way to do that is to advocate, you know, renegotiating the deal so it's a softer Brexit for all UK, then look, that's the priority. And that's probably the best strategy to go for. Eventually, we will look to rejoining, obviously. But I think that's a 10, 15, maybe even 20-year project. And I don't think that's likely in the foreseeable future.
Do you think that the result for the Labour Party was more to do with its position on Brexit, or do you think it was more to do with the manifesto or the leadership? What do you think was the root cause of the Labour Party's failure to win at the last election?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it was an issue of credibility, and that ultimately rested on one main issue, which was a perception of Jeremy Corbyn. Now, I don't believe that perception is a reality. You know, people didn't believe he was competent, people didn't trust him, to varying degrees, but there was an idea of a lack of confidence. Now, that perception was, I believe, the reason that we lost. In terms of the manifesto is overwhelmingly popular, particularly as individual policies. I mean, public ownership of utilities, you know, our green industrial revolution policy, all these are individually popular. Obviously, when presented as a whole, that might not be seen as credible, but I think that's a separate issue. And I think it'd be a massive, massive mistake to try and go back from the 2019 manifesto, which made significant progress on the economy and on many issues. In terms of the Brexit policy, look, you know my views on that as an advocate for a people's vote and for Labour to call for a people's vote. If I believed, like, ultimately I would be, you know, after this defeat, I would be humble enough to say I got it wrong, but I don't believe, looking at the evidence, that was the case. Labour obviously needed to have a Brexit policy, and it was right, ultimately, that we advocated for a policy that we believed that the people should have their say. The political implications of that, people seem to be reading, you know, too much into results of constituencies, not understanding the ecological fallacy that people who, a majority in a constituency doesn't necessarily reflect the minority of Labour voters. And even, you know, the majority of Labour voters in every constituency in the country are Remainers, and that reality still exists now as it does when Labour made the decision. But ultimately, for it to be made the case that Labour's loss was the result of every second referendum policy, that would have to be evidenced by a reduction in support for the party when that policy was announced in July, and that absolutely wasn't the case. We were polling in the mid-20s after a disastrous local and European election campaigns. It could be argued that those were distinct, you know, particularly the European elections. People might use that as a protest vote, and they might. But ever since that, then our polling increased. I mean, you know, went nowhere near enough to win an election, but our position increased. So what I'm saying is, a soft Brexit policy was not the direction to get a majority or to stop the Tories getting a majority. We had to pick a side. We didn't make that case convincingly enough. But I would argue that whatever case we made, the perception of our leader as incompetent was a far, far more potent thing. And that's what I picked up on the doorstep.
So obviously, as a result of the election, Jeremy Corbyn has triggered a Labour leadership contest. We've just had the MP nomination, and MEP, I don't know why they're still involved, seeing as this not going to have the job so much longer, but that nomination stage has just gone through, so there's five candidates left. Do you know who you are supporting yet? And if so, why? And if not, who are you sort of considering?
Sure. So I'll be supporting Rebecca Long-Bailey in this election. I think she's the best candidate to continue the good things that the past 4 years have brought us, being a resolutely anti-austerity and anti-war party, particularly actually the movement to a fantastic Green Industrial Revolution policy that she wrote. So in terms of the policies, in terms of the domestic and foreign policy, she's absolutely spot on. And look, she's identified where we need to change, particularly on the anti-Semitism. She wrote a fantastic article. She's signed up to the Board of Deputies' 10 commitments, and her judgment has always been in the right place on this particular issue. And look, I think she is the person to reach out to those communities that voted to leave and in the so-called ex-red wall. You know, Rebecca represents a Salford constituency. She gets it. She gets the issues that matter. And also, you know, equally importantly, it'd be great to have a woman leader. I think it's frankly shocking that we haven't had a female leader, despite being a party of equality, and that needs to change at this leadership election.
Of course, we won't just be seeing a Labour leadership contest. We'll also be seeing a deputy leadership contest. Have you thought of who you're going to be supporting in that contest?
Without a shadow of a doubt, Angela Rayner. She's absolutely fantastic as our Shadow Education Secretary. On grammar schools when she started, but throughout, on moving the times from when university offers are given, she's led the agenda on education for the past 3 years, holding respective education secretaries, including most notably Gavin Williamson, to account. She's been fantastic in that. She's really the person to unite the party. Everyone likes Angela Rayner. She has a fantastic backstory and a brilliant story to tell. She's brilliant in the media. So as you can tell, I quite like Angela Rayner.
What are your thoughts on sort of the other candidates running for Labour leader? What sort of, I guess, are there some that you'd mind less than others, or are you 100% behind Rebecca Long-Bailey, like, and no, Rebecca Long-Bailey or bust sort of levels?
No, not at all. I mean, there's lots of talent across the Labour Party, across the Shadow Cabinet, particularly Keir Starmer. I find him very convincing, and I'd really like him to play an enormous role in a hopefully Rebecca Long-Bailey administration. I think he's forensic. He's got a great attention to detail. Look, ultimately, I think the two characteristics that I'd like to change, I don't think it's particularly a policy disagreement, although I do disagree with some of his voting on the welfare bill, for instance, remind me something else. I can't remember for now. But I think to have a Northern North London MP would be wrong, although he is an Arsenal fan, correctly. And to have another man would be disappointing at this time. But look, I think he has a great role to play. Lisa Nandy equally was someone I've admired for years. Obviously, I disagree with her, you know, to a very large extent over the Brexit question. Perhaps that's been solved now, but you know, I'm less convinced about her than I was. But you know, I'll certainly be giving her a preference. Emily Thornberry, I'm not sure she'll be getting onto the ballot. A great media performer, but someone whose political judgment is perhaps suspect, particularly on, you know, on the issue of Leave voters, that famous tweet, maybe we shouldn't hold that against her to her still. This whole Caroline Flint thing, which she says is nonsense, and perhaps is. But at least her perception, as with Keir, about him sort of a North London-based party, we need to get out of that. and, you know, be at the heart of the regions. I'm not a particularly Jess Phillips fan, to be honest with you. I think she's weak on detail, weak on policy. And I'm not, you know, not very comfortable with some of her views on transphobia and some of the people that she's engaged with during that debate. So I'm particularly uncomfortable with that. But I would say if I had to rank them for you at the moment, it would be Rebecca number one, in terms of preferences. So Keir Starmer number two, Lisa Andy three, Emily four.
What are your feelings about the deputy leadership contest? Is it that you can only support Angela, or do you feel that there are other candidates that if they became deputy leader that you wouldn't mind? I mean, what are your feelings about that particular race?
Yeah, I mean, there's an absolute plethora of talent in the deputy leadership election, particularly Dawn Butler and Rosanna Alencarne, two fantastic Labour advocates, and two people that definitely should be in a future shadow cabinet, the future front bench. I'm less convinced that by Richard Bergen. I don't think he's very competent. I think he's a very good media performer, and his views on claiming that Zionism are the enemy of peace are anti-Semitic, and his seeming non-apology for that. And also Ian Murray, I think is a particularly divisive figure in the party. I think his conduct around the 2016 coup was suspect, and I don't think he's the person to unite the parties as a deputy leadership role should be, and always has been. And for what it's worth, I do think it's an important role. I know there was an attempt to get rid of it with the past incumbent, but I do think it's the deputy leader has a massive role to play within the party.
So you mentioned Emily Thornberry possibly not getting on the final ballot because obviously there's still the stage of unions and CLPs nominating. Do you think that that's a fair way of doing the leadership election, or do you think there could be changes in the process?
I think it's about right, to be honest. I think it balances having a wide range of candidates without having people who are, you know, who are going to waste time within that debate and not having too many candidates. I think it gets it right because it has a balance between support within the parliamentary party, which is at a decent stage of 10%, and allowed candidates from seemingly all factions of the PLP to get on the ballot. Equally, it's vital that candidates will have trade union support. I mean, with a party of trade unions were founded by them, and it's really important. And also in terms of grassroots activist support, I'm less convinced by that. I think it's vital within the final stage, and that's one member, one vote is the right system to have. But in terms of like CLP meetings, it's not necessarily accessible to all members. Not everyone turns up, and it might not be a fair reflection. So if I was to make a tweak, I'm broadly happy with the system. If I were to make one tweak, it would just be that it would be PLP plus the unions and affiliates, of course, and socialist societies. The CLP meetings to me seem a bit hit and miss, and ultimately, every member gets a say as a member, not just who turns up to a meeting in the final round.
What do you think would be the direction that the Labour Party would go in if Rebecca Long-Bailey and Angela Rayner won their respective contests? What do you think that they would keep as part of the previous Corbyn regime? What do you think that they'd change?
Sure, I think the latter question is a lot easier to answer. And look, when you lose an election, it's often quite tempting to say we got everything wrong. Equally, when you win an election, it's tempting to say we got everything right. Mm. Obviously, it's somewhere in between and there's a balance to be had. But I do think, in terms of policy, we did get almost everything right. And it was the delivery and seeming credibility of that was the issue, not the policy itself. So I'd be surprised if there were particular changes on that. Interestingly, a more constitutional policy, which hasn't really been focused on in public discourse for the past couple of years, is House of Lords abolition. A good policy from Rebecca Long-Bailey over the weekend. But in terms of differences, I think Rebecca signing up to the 10 commitments is very from the Board of Deputies is very strong, and particularly the commitment to an independent disciplinary process will have a huge impact, I feel. On the Labour Party's complaint process, not just for anti-Semitism, but for all forms of discrimination, actually. I think that will be a change of the culture of the party quite significantly. And also, I mean, to add to that, not a policy point, but the fact we'd have two Greater Manchester leaders, two women, would help to change the culture of the party out of what, you know, might be seen on the doorsteps as a London-based party.
So, funny you mentioned the abolition of House of Lords thing. Actually, that might be one of the few Labour policies to be adopted that I might agree with.
Fantastic. Welcome to the movement, comrade.
But on that the issue of the leadership, in terms of how they might sort of position themselves, do you think that Rebecca Long Bailey would be able to win an election?
Yeah, I do.
I guess there's the other thing about maybe that they're Labour too far behind and they would need another election to sort of one to get halfway there and then sort of another one to win.
So I think because politics is so volatile at the moment, I do think we can do it in one election. If not, you know, I think we've got a few more seats, not many, than the Tories in 2005. And they were able to obviously get into government via a coalition, which isn't ideal, but we're able to get into government at the next election. So it would need a big swing, but it's very possible with almost all those leaders that we'd be able to do that, particularly given the state of the economy. I mean, we're due a recession at some point soon, just given the state of the economic cycle, similar to the 2005 to 10 parliament, that will obviously have implications for the government's ability to be re-elected. But also, if we do end up with a Canada-style Brexit, I think that would add to that. And look, Brexit voters aren't likely to say we got this wrong over Brexit, but what they are likely to do is blame the government's handling of it. So I think the combination of the economic changes just from the economic cycle plus Brexit puts Labour in a decent position. I'm not denying the scale of it. It'll be a huge task. But also, I mean, given a few seats in London, for instance, where the Lib Dems sort of 15%, allowed the Tories to slide in over 40 with Labour on sort of 35. I think those seats, there'll be a different dynamic. Like Chipping Barnet, for instance, they'll be a lot easier to take back and say seats we're targeting at the beginning of the last Parliament. Seats like Bolton West, which now are Nuneaton, so ones we need to get a majority with 8,000. Maybe they would require a second election. You know, I'm not convinced, given the state of the volatility of politics, that it necessarily would. It's a big task, but I think it's certainly doable.
You mentioned the coalition there and the state that the Conservative Party was in the 2005 election. If Labour was in a position at the next election to form a coalition, is there any particular party that you would prefer to be in government with, the Labour Party, the SNP, the Lib Dems?
I'm obviously the Greens would be my first preference, but they probably will stay with one seat. You know, as we discussed last time, well, I'm an advocate for a limited electoral pact with them. Mm-hmm. And I'd be happy to stand down for them in, say, the Isle of Wight and help them maybe get a second seat there. They're, you know, our closest ideological partners. There's issues there, but they're, you know, they're the party we're closest to. If it's a straight choice between Lib Dems and SNP, it's like choosing between Liverpool and United to win the league. Whichever the maths work better with, probably the SNP, but there's not much in it.
Mm-hmm. So, I was mentioning the SNP. They had a very strong election and they took up quite a few seats off Labour. Yeah. What do you think Labour has to do in Scotland to sort of win back seats there? Or do you think that almost that you should sort of concede to the SNP having Scotland and that their sort of demands for a second referendum on independence?
So I have to be honest, I don't know all the solutions with regards to Scotland, and I think we need to give a lot more credence to the views of what Scottish Labour members have to say. I'd be open, for instance, to letting Scottish Labour become an independent part of a Labour Party rather than what it's characterised as a branch office, which I don't think is fair, but increasing the autonomy will never won't harm that. We seem to have tried almost everything. Blair is unpopular with them. Miliband, obviously, we still had one MP, similar with Corbyn. So the answers nationally don't seem to be, when they change for us, they don't seem to be really answering the problems up in Scotland. Perhaps, and this is easier in theory than practice, it will be shifting the debate from those constitutional questions to economic ones. And particularly, I think that would be easier with Brexit, given, we'd have left by then. The Scottish independence question is a different one. Equally, that could be sorted by then. But, people will be bored of it. And I think the the salience of Boris's get Brexit done message actually does allow us to sort of, it's fertile territory to say enough with these constitutional questions, let's get back to the real issues that matter. That was seen to win an election. As I said, easier said than done, and we need to listen to what Scottish Labour have to say more.
Just moving away from the United Kingdom and the Labour Party for a moment, we're coming closer and closer again to the US presidential election, and of course the Democratic primaries will be starting soon. What is your feeling about the current choice of presidential candidate for the Democrats? Are you optimistic about it? How are you feeling about it at the moment?
Yeah, I am optimistic that that Bernie Sanders will do it. I think Joe Biden is declining, and I think that's a good thing. Obviously, Bernie's current debates with Liz Warren aren't ideal. They're both two good candidates. But ultimately, I do think Bernie has the path to victory. And I really think that's a great thing. And I would like to see him and Elizabeth Warren reconnect and hopefully have her on the ticket.
So obviously the thing between Bernie and Warren, so people aren't, if listeners aren't aware of it, the sort of stem around a disputed claim that Bernie may or may not have made that a woman cannot become president. He claims he didn't say it, Warren claims he did. Do you think a woman can become president, or do you think society in America and other countries, but America's really in this context, is too sort of sexist to actually allow women to get to that position?
I mean, it seems to me quite similar to the Caroline Flynn, Emily Thornberry debate. But look, I mean, I'm not to deny the impact of sexism on politics. I think we see that very regularly with perceptions of female politicians. I think Jo Swinson, I'm not a fan of hers, but was a victim of that. Equally, you know, Rebecca Long Bailey has been victim to that as well. With regard to the America case, I mean, look, they have a particular system, but let's not forget that the first female presidential candidate got a majority of votes. You know, she didn't win the presidency, of course, and that's never going to be enough. But a majority of Americans did vote for a woman. And I do think that whilst it was an issue, Hillary Clinton could have won that campaign, very much could have done. And I think, you know, had James Comey not written a letter, then I think we would be, that question would be hypothetical, and we'd be talking about Hillary's second term.
Speaking of the potential of a second term, of course, as we know, Donald Trump is likely to be the Republican nominee at the election. How do you think the American politics and the American left would react if, regardless of who the Democratic nominee was, if Trump won a second term? How do you think that they would react to that?
Yeah, with absolute sheer indignation that we have here in Britain. Obviously, second terms do seem to be common in the US, so I don't think there'll be much surprise, but you know, the reaction of the left would be of extreme disappointment and sadness that this guy has got over the line twice, and perhaps it's an indictment of the US. I mean, that this guy, what more does he have to do to not be, you know, re-elected? What more does he have to say? And I think, yeah, that would lead to a lot of disillusionment. Obviously, it would depend on the context of you know, which states were lost. You know, are we losing the Rust Belt again? But look, I mean, with a left candidate like Bernie, I think the case in the Rust Belt is a lot stronger. So I do feel more optimistic with a more left-wing candidate that we could actually challenge that and challenge the Trump winning in states like Ohio and Michigan, Wisconsin, etc. So I do think there is a path to victory. But yeah, if Trump were to get elected, that would be very, very bad.
Do you think there's parallels to be made between sort of Corbyn and Bernie Sanders as sort of two maybe older left wing, not party establishment candidates? And does that not, isn't that not a warning sign to the Democrats maybe about his chances of winning elections, seeing what we've seen with Jeremy Corbyn?
No, I think it's two entirely different contexts. I mean, you could say in theory that the US hostility to socialism, at least in theory, might make it even more problematic, but I actually don't believe that. I think it wasn't Jeremy Corbyn's socialism that lost us the election. It was far more ideas about you know, the perceived link of terrorism, etc. For what it's worth, I do think Bernie is actually a more articulate politician. So he could perhaps make that economic case far more clear. Obviously, the anti-Semitism issue, was it a big issue in the British election? Maybe, maybe not. But obviously, Bernie is a proud Jewish socialist and can make that case very effectively, particularly against a candidate who's as anti-Semitic as Trump. And I will say that Trump is anti-Semitic. So I don't think the issues will be the same. That being said, I mean, there was the possibility that Corbyn could have worked. Corbyn could have won an election here. It wasn't to be the case, but as I said before, when we lose, you can perhaps read too much into it. Ultimately, he didn't win twice, but that doesn't mean that the message wouldn't have done. And there's other contingent factors at play. Ultimately, we did lose, and that's an outcome. But in terms of the outputs that go in, I'm not convinced that necessarily a left-wing case is not ripe for victory. But equally, like, what options do we have? Because look at Remain, look at Hillary Clinton, look at the state of social democratic parties in Europe. The centrist case is not, when it meets a populist right, is not faring well.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to have you on again, Nathan, and to discuss the various issues that we have done. So I'd like to ask, we're recording this in January 2020, it's a new year, it's a new decade. What New Year resolutions have you made?
Do you know what? I actually haven't made any. I can't think of one on the spot for you, but I do believe that time is a cultural construct. We should be aspiring to make change in all times of the year, not specific ones. So I do think that is kind of arbitrary, although very important to many people. If I thought of one on the spot, if I were to give you one, it's Peter, for Arsenal to improve under our new manager, Mikel Arteta.
Well, on that somewhat philosophical note, it's been great to have you on again, and we'd be delighted to have you on the podcast at some point again in the future.
Thanks very much, Will.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed listening to the podcast. If you'd like to follow us, you can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean and YouTube. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do @debatedpodcast. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do @thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope you listen to the next one.